Conference record has joined the conference.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi, Dan Sisto here.
Jim Talon here.
Hey, Jim.
How are you, Dan?
Pretty good. I couldn't make the meeting in person though either, so.
Oh, okay. I'm actually over at the Education Department, and I'm still running through a Regents meeting, so I'll be on for about a half hour now, and then I'll be off for a half hour, back on for an hour, and, you know, I'll just come in when I can, so. Are we going to be muted, or I guess we can't be if you're
I don't know. You and I are talking anyway.
Good.
We're clicking, it sounds like.
Ready to go. Dan's on the phone.
Yeah, Dan and Jim Talon, too.
And Jim Talon.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. It's 10:30, which is the time that is scheduled to begin the Payment Reform and Quality Measurement Work Group discussion. So I welcome members of the work group, and I welcome members in the audience and interested parties. I'm Bill Streck. I'm the co-chair of this group. Dan Sisto is not here today physically, but he is on the phone as the other co-chair, and so will participate with me in the program today. I think you have all received the agenda, and I just want to begin the program by going around with introductions, then have John give you a brief outline of what we hope to accomplish, and then I will provide you the timeline by which I hope we accomplish this today, so that we have a sense of everyone will have a sense of our progress as we make it, I'll put it that way, and where we stand in terms of our self-assigned tasks. So with that, as I mentioned, I'm Bill Streck. I'm the chair of the Public Health and Health Planning Council.
Art Levin, Center for Medical Consumers.
Rick Abrams, Medical Society of the State of New York.
Marlene Zura, New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation.
Scott Cooper from St. Barnabas, New Bronx.
Neha Jacobs from New York Presbyterian Blood Health.
And the Vito Village Care. Santa Fe Central Government Office.
Greg Allen, Health Department.
John Ahlberg, Health Department.
Pat Rowan, Health Department.
Phil Mossman, Health Department.
So those are the members of our committee who could arrive promptly. There probably will be others who will come, but we will move ahead from there. And, John, you want to outline what you see as our plans today, and then I might outline how I see us getting there.
Sure.
How's that?
Good. I think the health department almost has everybody outnumbered here, so we think the ratio is favorable for us today. we appreciate everybody, coming today, and we do have a full day, even though the number of slides we tried to keep down to a minimum. We know that we've been inundating, folks with lots of information, and I think really today is about discussing the recommendations and the next steps we need to take. I think the goal for today will be to, pretty much land on the set of principles. Phil and folks took the input from last meeting and tried to incorporate those, into the principles. So for us to kind of reach general agreement on those, understand that it could still be some more back and forth that could, I think, take place via email and the like. But I think really what's also very important is that we walk away today with a set of principles as well as a set of recommendations that we all pretty much conceptually agree upon. Our task after this meeting is to go back and write a series of papers that, provides a little bit more background. These papers will be posted on the department's website, I think as early as November 1st, so we need to write the papers get those, you know, to folks to review and be on time with the submission to the larger MRT committee. So, you know, that's basically our goals for today. Greg will step through. There was a request, I think, by Mr. Talon and others to, you know, kind of talk through how all the pieces kind of fit together. So we'll talk about that at the onset, and but then dive right into the real work.
So if we just, for those of us trying to organize this in our heads today, Greg's going to begin. Let me step back. Our goal is to get through this material, approve the principles, approve in concept the recommendations, and so provide the department our impetus to write a paper that will then be posted on the website and serve as the substrate for further discussion and approval at the full MRT. The way we will go through this today is we'll begin with Greg will present putting the puzzle together, and we'll allot about 30 to 35 minutes for that presentation and discussion. And then we'll follow that with about a half an hour each for the guiding principles on payment, the guiding principles on quality, and then after that we will focus on the recommendations for payment reform. So that's, if you look at that, those are about half-hour blocks and would bring us to around 12:30. So at that time, we will have been through the principles and the first recommendation. We'll break for lunch at 12:30, resume at 1, at which time we will take on the remainder of the recommendations, those of quality, disproportionate share, and essential providers, allowing each of those approximately 30 minutes. That should bring us somewhere around 2:15 to 2:30 and allow time for discussion of the next steps as are presented in the slides. So that's a rough sketch of how we see the meeting unfolding. If we tumble to an unexpected brevity, that would be fine. I think there would be no complaints along those lines. But that's our format. That's everybody comfortable with that as a rough framework, so we can all be measuring where we are in terms of finishing our task. Our task today is to finish a thoughtful discussion. That's what we have to approach it. So with that, let's begin a thoughtful discussion, and Greg, are you going to lead off with your section there? Thank you.
Sure, thanks. Thank you, Dr. Stratt. So this slide has puzzle pieces on it. The first thing I would caution everybody to do is to read in what pieces of the puzzle are connected with others. This just really is laying out that there's somewhat of a complex landscape out there. I think members of this committee have certainly been expressing some concern about how these might come together. But I think it's very important for people not to take away, for instance, that we believe you can only achieve clinical integration through an ACO. That we do not believe the case. This is a nice slide with some of the various pieces on it. I would just say that as we're moving forward here, that this landscape will in some ways be shaped by the policy decisions that this committee and others are making, and that policymakers in Washington and Albany and other places will to help the shape. But what I'm going to present is by no means a cookbook for how the various pieces will come together. It's some draft thinking about ways that we might restructure the program, perhaps to do a few key important things. And I would submit that probably one of those most important things is to try to localize accountability for quality and outcomes, and to try to do this in such a way that providers that are delivering care feel incentivized to deliver the right kinds of care and feel less incentive to deliver the wrong kind of care, care that's either too long or too short, care that is, you know, directionally not critical to health. And so I think what we're trying to think about are ways that we could structure the program so that those kinds of localized incentives could be best actualized. And theoretically, just on this chart, and again, this is a draft for consideration. This is not finalized New York State Medicaid policy, but it is a way that we could begin to think about the groups. It's a little hard to see on the right-hand side, unfortunately, but I'll just read those labels on the right-hand side of this chart. This attempts to lay out the first row, if you will, of boxes are subpopulations. And we've really structured in many ways the program right now with a dividing line somewhat along acute care and long-term care, and we've built some managed care products around those lines. And this would add sort of another dimension to the thinking around this, which is, should we structure some products along the lines of how patients may present to the program, and could we tailor products to those higher need patients in a little bit more of a specific way? And that could be tailored in terms of the service delivery system. It could also be tailored in terms of the sort of risk management approach, which is that the second line of boxes are really just how would we structure the program in terms of the interface between the Medicaid program and the providers of care, and whether that be a plan, whether that be an integrated delivery system, ACO, or something in between those, like a special needs plan. And then the last line really is sort of, we label this care management approach. You can't see it up on the screen, but you can see it on the printed slides. And that starts to lay out various pieces of the puzzle and where would they fit. So I would describe the top line as who would get what kind of care structure. The second line is what might be the financial and the quality management interface on the risk management approach. And down below are care management tools that we could utilize in each of these streams in order to try to better organize care and to create some kind of incentive. And I think what often gets mixed and confused in the conversation, and understandably, are the care management tools that are in the bottom row with sort of that risk management approach in the second row. And really what we're laying out here is not, again, a recipe, but a set of options for consideration. And if you drew a line, if you will, between the high-cost, high-needs and the rest of the population, children and family, partial benefit folks, childless adults, I think the question is, should we dedicate some resources, and should we dedicate some service management and risk management that may look a little bit different than what we would deliver to those folks who have more traditional access patterns, may look a little bit more like the commercially insured population, may not need all of the resources that could be sort of rededicated, if you will, to the high-cost, high-need population. Patients would, of course, not always be living in one or two of these buckets, so we would have to think about the amongst and between relationships here. But down in the bottom are the tools that we have, and I'll try to step through, once everybody at least understands what the theoretical layout here is, I'll try to step through our thinking about how each of those bottom tools could be utilized. So left-hand high cost, high need, we've further divided that into non-long-term care and long-term care. Those dividing lines could be made around the nursing home eligible 120-day or more or other criteria that we could use. On the left-hand side, again, these are options, and there's others. We could utilize mainstream HMOs. We can utilize behavioral health organizations, integrated delivery systems. Some have pointed out we maybe should drag ACO up as a risk management approach into that line, and I think that would be fine. Just the concept here is that we could utilize a variety of purchasing mechanisms to interface with the population based on what is available in the community. So for those communities where there's a very strong integrated delivery system, where the state may contract directly with a set of incentives and disincentives, probably on a preferred full capitated integrated approach. But again, there's room here for discussion about partial capitation and shared risk. But on the non-long-term care acute side, those would be the sort of risk management approaches. On the long-term care side, we've got the managed long-term care, the partial plans, we've got full plans. There may be some desire to move those partial plans toward more of a fully integrated product, which would include acute care and long-term care. We could utilize mainstream HMOs in beginning to build out the management of the long-term care population, which is probably going to be critical to the success of our overall care management for all approach. maybe there's another model. There may be a provider-sponsored or another kind of model that could be embraced as part of the move to doing long-term care monitoring. And then on the right-hand side of the chart, I think we're just basically just saying that we've made market improvements with using the HMO product on quality over the period. There really is pieces that we can continue to strive toward, but for those individuals where the integrated care is probably achievable through a patient-centered medical home without extra resources, we could propose that the risk management approach, as it's currently constructed for most of our members without high cost, high need, may be working. And what the job there may be adding those tools down on the care management side, building out patient-centered medical homes, using accountable care organizations, again, potentially as a contracting vehicle, utilizing health homes as a way for those who have perhaps multiple chronic illnesses but don't cross over to the threshold of high need, that we could utilize the health home, again, as a service resource underneath the HMO product. And I think the same would be for children and families, childless adults. Maybe we build a specialized benefit. Maybe we do not for partial benefit. Just flashing back to the left-hand side for a second on the high cost, high need, an example of this is of the potential need here is we've got foster care children, mental health children, largely unmanaged, some of them being managed under the group structure, others out in families in the community, without real organization of their care. And there could potentially be an option here where we could build a specialized product for high-risk children that could potentially borrow from a SNP model, perhaps regionally, that would focus on the particular needs of that population. Maybe we even build a specialized health home for those children underneath that sort of risk management approach, which could be a specialized needs plan, perhaps with some providers who have knowledge of children's needs woven into the fabric of the ownership and the delivery of that risk management and service management product. I'm going to show up in a minute. I'll just say that as we're looking again at that left-hand side, health home again becomes a tool to achieve better outcomes by localizing accountability and building a care management resource into the service delivery system. We are not envisioning health home in and of itself to be a risk management approach. We're viewing it as a service in the service delivery system with some resources to achieve a focus on outcome for that portion of our patient population that has multiple chronic illness. So I think theoretically we're just trying to separate organizationally how we would achieve risk management and care management on the services side from how we would run resources around care management. Same thing on patient-centered medical home. Again, an evidence-based tool in the service delivery system for achieving higher outcomes, both with high-cost, high-need populations and with everybody else. And I get into that differentiation a little bit on the next slide. And then the integrated delivery system in ACO, I think there's an argument that that could be utilized as either a risk management approach and a service access tool and or as a potential tool for driving change down on the service delivery side from a care management perspective. And that's where I think the ACO and the integrated service delivery system could potentially have a foot in both camps of achieving risk management and potentially also at the provider level, achieving some kind of localized accountability inside the service delivery system. We probably will not have that kind of a product available in every market, probably hard to achieve in rural areas, for instance, so that may be specialized and tailored for those markets where that kind of horsepower exists. And with that, I'll take a breath and answer questions or listen to comments.
Comments or questions thus far?
This is Dan.
Oh, okay. Dan?
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure I understood that there was an openness to the potential, at least, of an IDS or ACO to move up, not just in the high-need category, but in the children, families, and children, adults, potentially, as well. Is that correct?
It's correct. And again, I think we could add to this chart by putting ACO potentially IDS up in our risk management strategy as an option. It's certainly an option, and also adding integrated delivery system down below on the, as you're saying, Dan, over on the right hand side of the chart for the non high cost high need. I think that's fair from a theoretical perspective.
Yeah, I agree. There wouldn't be too many for at least for some years, but there might be a few.
Well, I mean, I think an example of that is we currently have a lot of partially capitated arrangements for primary care down to a delivery system, and so we utilize that as a care management vehicle for folks that are not high-cost, high-need. So I think it's fair to kind of list it there. As a risk management approach, I think there's just a policy question about whether or not there's anything broken with the current mainstream HMO product from the perspective of service delivery to those patients. But I think it's fair to raise it as an option.
Sorry to come in when you have the microphone
turned on. It's a button.
I am not a surgeon. I'm not a surgeon, so. I'm sorry to come in the middle, but I want to make sure I understood what you just said correctly, which is I think it's important to really distinguish between an HMO model that's grafted on top of a fragmented delivery system and, admittedly, ACOs can be whatever you think they are to some extent because they're elusive, but I have a clear vision of one, which is full integration of insurance with a fully integrated delivery system. So if I understood Dan's question or query, it's important not to discourage anything other than full integration for all populations that we're going to be taking care of. And I dare say more than the ones that you're most focused on, which are Medicaid, understandably, but I would include commercial and Medicare. And even consider, because it is slightly different, third-party administrative plans. Every patient we take care of in the state, ultimately, in the end, we want to have the best access and the most integrated delivery systems that keep the money in the system. So I think HMO, I understand why people can default to them and they do certain things, but they're not all one, and they're not exactly what I think we should be driving towards if we're redesigning payment and redesigning the delivery system.
So the sum of these comments would suggest what Dan said, that risk-bearing networks or integrated system should be up there on that. I like your distinctions here. I think they're quite helpful, but I do think that would be an important consideration.
Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the presentation because it seems to me, you know, and again, apropos to what Dan was saying, you know, you really are taking great pains to inject flexibility, you know, and breadth, if you will. You know, I do understand the need for organization, but and perhaps I missed it. See, to me, as we begin to restructure and reinvent how both the payment system and the care delivery system, and again, I agree with Steve, it should go way beyond Medicaid. To me, probably the most critical component here is how are you going to evaluate improvement? How are you going to evaluate cost savings? And I believe that, and again, it's easy for me from the outside to say this, but I believe that that's where the rubber meets the road. And I would be more focused on that than and again, you didn't say this, than trying to fit either a particular provider of care or what I hope, a collaboration of providers of care into a particular box. I mean, what I would like to see, whether it's through a request for proposal or whatever mechanism you use, is basically say, here's what we want. You know, we want to reduce avoidable hospital admission, pediatric admissions in the South Bronx, and then leave it to the hospital, the physicians, the long-term care facilities to put together a proposal that says, yes, we're going to do this, and then set up a very, very, not overbearing, but comprehensive evaluation mechanism so that over 12 months, 18 months, 24 months, you can say, well, were you successful or weren't you? And if you weren't successful, why weren't? So I think I would like to see the focus, and hopefully through the waiver applications that the state either has or will put in, that kind of flexibility can be injected into our delivery system.
Sure. And I just a quick response to that, which is that I think the framework for some of that might live on the work that Pat's folks have been doing on the high-cost, high-need side for Health Home. I think what we've done there is we've isolated some measures that we think are critical that probably could just be woven into whatever we recommend relative to waiver performance measures.
Scott? Yeah, I think that the breakdown in categories is important. But I think that it's important from the standpoint of applying appropriate reimbursement structures to manage those populations. What I am concerned about is that sometimes, in my opinion, evolves into a greater fragmentation of the delivery system. I'm very wary of setting up SNPs for every different disease that we have available. I understand that on the far top left, that's your high cost, and that's where we want to direct energies at this point. But to start to try and fragment delivery systems in such a way that those people are going to have one model, and childless adults are going to have a second model, and families are going to have a third model, and people who were born on Tuesdays are going to have a fourth model, and I'm being facetious to make a point, I'm afraid that's not the way healthcare is in the real world, and that we make arbitrary distinctions based on cost, not on social dynamics, that within any one family you could have five different plans, theoretically, if you start to make this into SNPs. So although I think that to Steve's point, it's important that we have alternatives of delivery systems, we've got to be careful they not be defined by the patients. They be defined by the reimbursement structure or the mechanisms and the manners in which we're caring for people and care managing. But if we're going to try and define every disease and give it its own needs and its own plan, I think we're going to fail.
I just want to say something that is an excellent point. And I think I didn't spend enough time probably framing this, which is this is a potential vision for how to achieve care management for all, how to get out of fee-for-service, how to evolve from managed fee-for-service into some form of care management. And what exists in that risk management row, we're really thinking about are the policy options available to the state and its providers, and not necessarily an expressed preference for one over the other. And I think that there's strengths and weaknesses with going one way or the other way. But clearly, I think what we're thinking about is patients that were in any given disability bucket for which we did build a SNP would still have the option, as they do now under the HIV SNP, to choose a mainstream product. I think that's important because patients may choose that their regular primary care access as being more critical than the specialty management. So I think it's an important point, Dr. Cooper.
I totally agree. And I would say that the is it working?
Yes.
Sorry.
Very well.
The charts you showed in the first meeting we had on the million that were exempt from the current Medicaid program make that point, because as we began to dig into it, multiple subpopulations had mental illness or drug addiction. And to wall off mental illness or drug addiction, you're precluding the opportunities because they really travel with, you know, so many other conditions, and it gets overly bureaucratic and complicated to care for those patients.
Dr. Streck, I was just going to appeal to you that some of these questions may be somewhat addressed by the next slide. If I finish the next slide, I'm done with my whole section. That's up to you.
I'll have to. Okay.
Marlene and Pat had their hands up, so.
Don't know which.
First of all, I just would like to congratulate you on trying to do something that's long overdue, which is manage a very complex population, fragile population with significant needs in a way that makes sense. So, I think everyone agrees in the audience, even though this conversation is sort of getting into a different mode. That being said, I think the suggestion I would have is think about alignment of incentives. Think about where you set up situations where you might have folks that you want working together, not working together. And, you know, case in point, the VHO and the health home, where, you know, there may be situations where the VHO has a particular mandate and the health home has a different mandate and they may be swimming in opposite directions and exhausting each other. The second thing that I would like to sort of advise you on is think about the transition. A lot of the population is now in fee-for-service. I'm particularly concerned about the SSI population that has the carved-out fee-for-service and the managed care plan. That managed care plan, although they have a very long history with that person, has not had any relationship to their mental health needs. And they're attached to a provider that does have a relationship to their mental health needs, yet not a relationship to their physical health needs, and we have to figure out how to deal with that. So I would also, as a final statement, suggest that before you dive into populations like the foster care population, and we've discussed the homeless population, you would need a separate work group. I would think, I did a work group when I was in the city on the foster care Medicaid program. It's very complex, and the stakes are very high.
Pat?
So, just a couple of observations. Again, I really like the way that you laid this out. I think it's great to sort of do it schematically. I think that on the right-hand side of the chart with sort of the mainstream programs and the mainstream managed care program, as somebody mentioned, there's a lot of experiences, a lot of history with the benefits that have been managed, and I think there's a very good track record. The left-hand side of the chart obviously could, like, kind of go around the room once you start breaking it out into the subpopulations, and it's a very vulnerable population, and the benefits have been carved out because of the understanding that people are very vulnerable. I would not start so much from the top as from the bottom, because I think that people get hung up and go much too quickly to, this is a delivery system that is needed by this client, the family, whatever, and bingo, it should be a SNP, or bingo, it should be an IDS that has an insurance function, whatever. I think it's very, you know, people can't resist kind of going to the, let's do the shape of the table kind of discussion and who gets the money and how does it flow. I'm a little bit less concerned about that, especially on the left-hand side of the chart. I think it's really important to figure out first the delivery system for these clients, which, you know, I think your boxes at the bottom encapsulate a lot more than the traditional health home, you know, your concepts around housing and supports. I mean, it's a very different population, right? And that when you start to get to the box above about, I think, what you're describing is sort of the financing vehicle, it's fine. What you have there is fine, and there may be more, there may be fewer, but I do think that in that box there are certain principles that should apply. Number one is to try, unless it is really, really essential, to treat the person as one person in one system and not as the combination of five different medical, behavioral, social and other states that require five different entities getting five streams of money to try to manage that person. That's just the wrong way to do it. The second is that those entities be accountable and therefore have the tools to be accountable for the ability to report data, provide information on the outcomes that you want to see, and that you actually hold those entities responsible for those outcomes, you know, quality, efficiency, member experience, and that however, whatever you want to put into that box, you know, that those themes apply. And that the third thing is, you know, just in terms of the sort of administrative efficiency of the system, every time you create another box, you're creating more administrative expense. So why would you want to do that? So I'm being careful here because I'm a mainstream HMO, and I know that a lot of folks think that mainstream HMOs should not do behavioral health, for example, or should not do this or should not do that, and that we need special needs plans. I'm not expressing an opinion on that. I think that the mainstream HMOs, including my own, need help, and we want to get better at that stuff. But I think there's a difference between the entity that kind of handles the insurance risk or what have you and the delivery system. And I think there are a lot of ways to empower and organize and incentivize the delivery system short of creating, you know, five new categories of SNPs. And I'm just picking on SNPs because everybody uses that term.
Okay. I think this is a good introduction to your next slide because everyone's at the lower part of your diagram with the delivery system boxes and the consequences. So why don't you go through that?
Sure. And this chart shares some of the imperfection of the puzzle chart, which is that it's hard to really graphically, there's no linear relationships here. But up at the top, this really is just trying to lay out the care management tools that we have. So at the top we have this, I'm just putting together the risk management approach, and I'll just say the service authorization, air traffic control piece of managing the system. And I think there we're just, you know, again, repeating the conversation that somehow we want everybody in some form of management at the upper level. And I think there's some express preference for those financing vehicles to be more integrated rather than less integrated, to have the risk tend towards the fully capped rather than the partially capped. Again, there's downstream accountability effects that can potentially be improved by having more service responsibility in one place. I think the point that Marlene raised about the fragmentation of the carve-out, for instance, is something that routinely just about everybody is unhappy with. I mean, September ago, we met with mental health advocates, and nobody was willing to raise their hand for fee-for-service management anymore. And I think that's of moment that the system's come to the point where the delivery system itself is saying we need a better interface, and a carve-out of physical health care and behavioral health care is no longer rational. We need to bring the benefit together, and we need it to somehow have a single point of accountability. And that accountability should somehow, as we flow down through the chart, result in what I said at the beginning, which is localized accountability, that when I practice harder on behalf of a hard patient, there's reward in that for me. And when I practice harder on a less difficult patient, that there's some kind of risk in that for me. So up at the upper end, we want everybody in some form of care management. The BHO is a way station. I think the original MRT enacted it as a three-year temporary vehicle to create a management interface over the top of fee-for-service and to eventually evolve into some risk-based contracting on the part of the state with an entity to hopefully have a fully integrated product for those people that need both behavioral health care and physical health care. And I think the options, again, are mainstream plan with the services carved in, or some kind of SNP or specialized service delivery with responsible for both physical health care and mental health care, and perhaps both products being available in our larger markets. And again, there's no, with that, those are the options. I'm not expressing a preference for those. There is certainly the danger of overdoing the SNP.
Marlene?
I mean, as long as we're here, I know some of this stuff is kind of in the works anyway. I said, as long as we're here, and we're here to comment and potentially change the direction of the stuff on this slide, it is pretty misaligned to have the BHO approving services that the health home is coordinating, and at the end of the day, the health home is being evaluated on the quality of services that are being provided by the individual provider that the health home has no relationship with. And I'm going to say it because that's what I meant when I said, I think you need to kick the tires a little bit and get a little better alignment here, because that wasn't what you wanted.
Steve?
Yeah. I couldn't agree more strongly. And I think at the very least, this committee should be a voice articulating that message, because this hand-waving going on. And I don't think it's on the part of the department necessarily. I think it, some of the leaders in mental health are hand-waving. Either it's integrated or it's not integrated. And it's too important to get right. And the BHO solution as configured now, in my opinion, is going to fail.
Okay, we're going to give this five more minutes to this is really an introductory framework, and I think we're listing, there's an inventory of ideas that have been introduced, the BHO being one, Marlene's point about some of the populations. We'll get those inventories, and I'd ask for other comments about this as a framework for moving to our work for today. So other comments. Phyllis.
I just want to reiterate, I think, what Steve and Marlene are saying. When you look at when you did the quadrants, the fact that mental health was a comorbidity on such a substantial amount of the funds and people that were in high need, I also don't understand how you can't integrate that, because if you're responsible for the medical care, you got to deal with the mental health needs. If you're responsible for the mental health, you got to deal with the medical needs.
Well, normally I would be piling on, but I think that it's important that I do that, because I have to reiterate what has been said three times already and I was trying to get to earlier. I understand you've heard it. I'm not going to beat a dead horse, but it's critical. We cannot continue to fragment diseases. We have to understand that patient populations are going to be fluid constantly. So, again, I'm just adding my voice to that same drumbeat.
Oh, hell, I'll pile on, too.
Okay, we're going to have a penalty flag here for piling on.
Yeah, but in the first...
We need other comments. Go ahead, Pat.
The top bubble really does reflect, I think, what people are saying is not a good idea. There's too many types of entities up there for every single possible thing. And, again, you know, from my perspective, it's less about the delivery system may require specialized providers, specialized networks. That is not the same thing as having a separate insurance entity to fragment that data, fragment the care, not be able to communicate with the medical provider over here. I mean, it's really bad. It's just not the right way to go. I think that the state can, any way that you want to, you know, purchase the services that you want, but I think you have to purchase it through as few top-line entities as you want. You can make those entities show that they have the capacity underneath, that they have specialized networks that meet specialized requirements and all of the rest, but for purposes of data accountability and financial reporting and overall coordination, keep it simple at the top line. Keep it to as few entities as you can.
And I get it. I just say this, the MRT recommendation was not to leave fee-for-service without some management and to evolve towards some kind of integrated product. What I'm going to reframe what I'm hearing, and hopefully it'll be roughly accurate, is that you'd rather fast track to year three and get to this more fully integrated product than stay for a long time at this way station where we're doing concurrent inpatient review and all the rest. And I get that. The one commercial on the apology is that we have a state management team now on Health Home, which includes fully seated partners from Mental Health, Oasis, our partners in the AIDS Institute on the HIV side. We are actively reviewing these letters of intent for Health Home and making calls to build the local networks. So it is fully our intent to make the regional BHOs responsive and responsible to the activities of the Health Home. I'm not saying that that job will be easy, because we'll be busy implementing both initiatives. In some ways, on the efficiency side, they have a similar mission, but potentially on the access side, there may be some challenge to align those conversations. I will certainly take this back to our state management team as a concern about staying too long on the BHO side, and also a concern that we not work at cross purposes on the Health Home, which I think is a fair challenge to us. And I just finished this thing to say that
We think everybody should be in some evidence-based kind of primary care delivery. Patient-centered medical home is one way to achieve that. We think that health homes make sense for high-need populations because we can resource care management. And we don't want to lose track of, and if I did this slide correctly, I would have added Pat's piece about housing and social support over on the right side. But self-directed care is something that came loud and clear to us from many communities as part of the first MRT, and we just don't want to lose track of it as a piece underneath that primary care coordination that sometimes gets lost in the in-the-box medical home piece. And I'm done. I think these comments have been very right on target and helpful, actually.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for all the comments. Jim or Dan, have you any comments before we move on?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, that was a good start to our discussion, and we're on time, which is even more gratifying. So now let's move to the next topic, and that's the general guiding principles for innovative payment models. And John, are you going to lead this?
Yeah, I'll take a shot at that. I'll get things going here. So we wanted to take another shot at the general guiding principles. From our last meeting, we took the comments, and you can see when I go through them, we attempted to incorporate some of the discussion that was around the table. You also see that we merged some things together. I think the guiding principles are important. I think we're now thinking about writing the paper, and I think it's a good starting point to educate the public in terms of the foundations for our recommendations. And it also helped us as we draft the paper. But I think even more importantly, from your perspective, it's really the legacy that you'll leave behind, because we're going to ask you to endorse a set of broad recommendations. And as we move forward with implementation, I see ourselves going back to the guiding principles and saying, all right, how do we handle this situation? And so I think they're important to try to nail down our goal. I'm pretty sure as we go through them, hopefully we'll get through all of them, and we'll be fine. If we don't get all the way there within the allotted time, I think maybe the suggestion, and I think other groups have done this, is perhaps through emails, people can spend some time thinking more. But in the end here, very shortly, I think our goal is to be able to publicly release these principles. So with that, I'll just read through them. We've kept them divided up between payment and quality, since that was the overarching charge of this group. So with that, I'll just go through them. I'll read them. Let people take them in. Under innovation payment models, number one is to be transparent and fair, increase access to high quality healthcare services in the appropriate setting, and create opportunities for both payers and providers to share savings generated if agreed upon benchmarks are achieved. Number two, be scalable and flexible to allow all providers and communities, regardless of size, to participate, reinforce health system planning, and preserve an efficient, essential community provider network. Allow for flexible multi-year phase-in to recognize administrative complexities, including system requirements. Align payment policy with quality goals. Reward improved performance as well as continued high performance. Incorporate strong evaluation component and technical assistance to assure successful implementation. So those are the payment items. I think, again, we took our best shot at incorporating. We may have not gotten all the way there, but we went through our notes. And
so the motion's on the floor. Marlene.
I like number two. I don't exactly know to what it refers. I would like a little more explanation of that, because I don't know which part of our agenda that is addressing. But I also, and I don't want to beat a dead horse, the word patient is not anywhere in there. And it could be very nicely in there.
Yeah, I think it could be too. I think.
What is this talking about?
Well, I think what we've heard is that, New York State, obviously, very vast state, and different communities and their provider networks will be at different stages of being able to accept risk and grow into a new system. So we thought it was important that, it needed, whatever our initiatives are, payment or quality for that matter, right, need to fit the community, right, need to fit the needs of the community, need to fit the planning goals of the community. So when we say scalable and flexible, right, to allow providers and community, regardless of size, to participate, I mean, that's what we mean.
I would add the word patient.
Yes.
For consumers is a better word to that question. And I applaud you for putting it in there. I look forward to seeing how you use it.
How we implement that particular. Oh, I'm sorry.
Just with item two, and I think you guys are going here anyways, and it's clearly in the embedded in here, but I wonder if we might be willing to tweak it. So I'm just really cognizant of the community in which I work in Hudson Valley. Two-thirds of our primary care is still provided in practices of 10 or less, and you absolutely were trying to go here, allow all providers and communities, regardless of size, to participate. So I know that that was absolutely in the back of your head, trying to design to the community and where it is. I'm also cognizant that if you look at how the Medicaid costs are spread around, those two-thirds of the primary care in the Hudson Valley is, you know, a relatively small portion of costs, and that you have to design to some of the big settings where the big cost goes. I had wondered if you don't actually want to get into regardless of size, but say something along the lines of be scalable and inflexible to allow, you know, different kinds of settings to get in, because you're talking about an intervention that allows disaggregated primary care to find a way in. That intervention looks really different than, Steve, not to pick on you or New York Presbyterian, what you guys would do in highly organized integrated systems of care. You have maybe a lot of practices, but it's just fundamentally different, and I don't want to lose that. I also don't want to commit you guys to making the way for everyone to get there, because there's some pieces in item two that might be about high-performing providers. And you may not be saying, I want to take everyone, but I want to have interventions that are addressable for all groups that are ready to step up.
Mm-hmm.
Pat, you were next, and then Emma.
Just, you know, sort of harkening back to the conversation that we just completed, I would suggest, reflecting on the conversation we just completed, I would suggest consideration of adding as a goal for payment models that they reduce fragmentation and promote integration of care that is person-centered and not, you know, condition-specific. That's number one. And number two, maybe it's inherent in there, but I think it's worthwhile stating that payment models, innovative payment models, should be capable of measurement of and accountability for outcomes. I think we should introduce those concepts.
That's good. So you got both of those notes?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
It was basically my comment that I think we talked about at the end of the day having an integrated model, and the payments should support that model, and I don't see it here. So I think that was mainly my comment, and the accountability piece. And I think the accountability should extend to providers, consumers, and payers.
So the comments relate to integration of care that is patient-centered and integration of care with outcomes as a concept that the reimbursement system should generate some element of outcome in this. Does that cover the comments thus far?
Patient-centered.
I got that one. Yep. Are there other comments?
This is Mike Krupp.
Oh, Dan, go ahead.
You know, Dan, I was thinking the same thing, but what hits me is just something maybe the staff could keep in the back of their mind. If there's a paper to be written on the entire document, what was just stated really really extends beyond a payment model principle. I think it's so important to focus on that patient-centered or patient-focused integrated system and those visions that underlie this. That might be a good framing when paper is written for the overall MRP.
We definitely agree with that. I mean, I think that's another reason for us to get these principles down, because not only will it be shared with the public, I think it will also help who's charged with putting together the whole paper, which will have all the subcommittee recommendations. You know, maybe I think we should shoot to get that in the first or second paragraph. So I think that.
So let's make sure we just got the suggestions. We're comfortable. We got all the suggestions. So just want to read them back. And if, is that okay? Is that okay if Phil just reads back the suggestions, make sure that with.
Yes, I think that'd be a good. Okay, Phil.
Can you guys hear me on the phone?
Very well.
Yes, last part was a little fragmented, but go ahead.
Okay, this is Mike Kropp. Is it okay for me to say something?
Yeah, Mike, go ahead.
Go ahead.
With respect to integration, I just want to be careful that we don't go too far, that there's a concept of alignment that stops a little bit short of integration. And I'm concerned that integration might presume that there will be integrated, you know, systems and models everywhere, but I don't think that that is necessarily possible given the geographic diversity of the state and, you know, sometimes the difficulty of bringing entities together under one corporate umbrella. So I'd like to think about this as alignment around the patient's interest with the goal of reducing fragmentation, but integration for some people just is perhaps a bridge too far.
Yes. And Mike, this is Susan Stewart. I agree with that because I think it was part of my earlier comment as well, which is these two-thirds of primary care provided in the Hudson Valley and these small practices, we were watching the Medicare stuff come out fast and furious, and they can't access any of those programs unless we figure out a way to organize it for them. So they're just sort of left sitting out there. The large physician practices, the health centers can get in and do it, but they're just sort of sitting out there left behind, and they're key Medicaid providers in some small communities. I mean, they are the safety net in some places. And, you know, I think we have to watch how some of these innovative models are putting together, because I agree with what Pat's talking about in terms of having an integrated model and particularly an integrated payment model. But if the care delivery design can accommodate some changes and some ability for small providers to get to the table in the bottom piece on the delivery system, that's what I'm sort of talking about, because otherwise their choice is, do I go with a large multi-specialty group and just hope that that's not a multi-specialty group that has a lot of churn?
I agree completely.
Steve? No, wait a minute. Okay, Steve. Make sure everybody's in.
I think we should distinguish between a goal or a vision and the reality of how you get there. So in the first or second paragraph, I strongly believe we should incorporate some of what has been said about patient-centered or family-centered or an integrated care. And that needs to be the guiding principle. I'll beat up on myself. I can tell you that Montefiore has an integrated delivery system with aligned physicians who are employed, who use information systems and take prepayment. But we're not as integrated as we should be. We have to keep pushing ourselves to be even more integrated. And, you know, rural or suburban centers where people are practicing in ones or twos and so forth, may be no more challenging to become integrated with the rest of the delivery system than large urban situations. It's like the Holy Grail. I mean, integration of care. So they're all challenging, but the vision needs to be there, and I think it should be front and center.
Okay, Phil, why don't you read back what you have, and let's see if these collective editors have advanced our cause today.
Okay, reduce fragmentation of services and promote integrated patient-centered models. We need accountability for patient outcomes. Integration for all patients may not be possible to access the services issue. And then the vision statement that this extends beyond payment and put some framing language in whatever we lead in with the paper.
Okay, within
this is Dan.
Oh, Dan.
I just want to comment on integration. I think Mike Kropp's reference to alignment is helpful, because when I talk about integration to hospitals in all different parts of the state, from standalone to big ones, I do try to give them room, a place in that definition by saying that there are corporately integrated models, but there are also virtually integrated models where the it can be contracts, it can be joint agreements, it could be clinical integration models, the separate providers, but that there needs to be payment and other aspects, technology, administration, but payment models in one form or another should promote integration, even if they don't necessarily, it doesn't necessarily have to mean corporate integration, although I tend to think that in the long run turns out better most of the time because you're not serving four different masters. And so, you know, a North Shore and a Montefiore, you know, have shown you can take this and put it together even among a variety of sectors of delivery or horizontally or vertically. But the Long Island Health Network exists as well. And each can be, if they wanted to, each could be moved to be more patient-focused and more integrated with the delivery, irrespective of the corporate structure. So I think we could say integration, if you took that broad view of what it might mean, it could still provide a home for an independent doctor or an independent nursing home or an independent hospital, but it would be pushing them to develop those appropriate relationships.
So the sum of Dan's comments and the other comments, it seems to me, includes an addition here that says that integration and alignment are to be encouraged by the payment system. Is that a fair summary of what we're saying? That we broaden that, Susan's point, that it's more than the integrated system. So that's one fundamental addition to this, the patient-centered components and the Steve's retooling of the orientation of this, not only in this part of it, but as John, you've already said, in the first or second paragraph of the entire paper.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, are we content with this, given the fact that the ability to wordsmith this is infinite? Are we comfortable that we've gotten our ideas to the group and we'll await the next product? Okay. That's good. So let's move to...
We got quality next.
Quality next.
Right. And again, we thought
it was important to try to, you know, differentiate between the payment and the quality. So I'll just quickly read through these. Be transparent and fair. Be based on standard of care or evidence-based science. Be flexible enough to recognize advances in medicine that will improve patient care. Include patient experience measurement. Seek to align quality measurement across payers, including Medicare and others. Be appropriately risk-adjusted, especially when used to compare providers and make incentive payments. Align and incentivize providers across the continuum of care. Promote patient participation and responsibility in healthcare decision-making. Incorporate strong evaluation component and technical assistance to assure successful implementation. And include a public reporting process on measures and outcomes.
Arlene.
Per our last discussion, access is part of quality, so I think we need to say something about access. And we, you know, apropos of, I think, Greg's, you know, body of work, we're trying to get the right access for people so that they're using the right services. I think that's really important.
Yeah.
Well, to be a little argumentative, if I might, this is quality measures. You just want access as a quality measure. That's what you're saying, that that should be a measure.
If, for example, a provider does not provide the kind of access that the Medicaid population needs, I think that ought to be a factor in evaluating that provider.
Okay.
So I'm
still a little confused as to what these principles are guiding, because it suggests as if we're going to start from ground zero, you know, that was unintended. Right? We're going to start from baseline on developing measures, and here are the guiding principles. When the development of measures, although in its infancy, has a lot of reasonable history, and nothing here refers to it. I mean, so NQF's endorsed measures go through all, you know, a huge process of vetting and a set of criteria. Is this simply to say that any measures, whether they be NQF endorsed or NCQA or whatever, would have to meet these standards, or is there sort of a presumption that those measures meet? In other words, I'm trying to figure out what activity this is going to guide. Is it the choice of measures? Is it the development of measures?
I think that's a great point, Art. I think, in my opinion, I think it's really the choice of measures in terms of fitting what we're trying to do. It does have a framework that does, now that I'm rereading it in your eyes, of almost like there's nothing already out there. I think you want us to try to align what's already out there, what we're already doing with these principles. Is that fair?
Yes. And then just for seven, I mean, I think we can shorthand it as to promote shared decision-making.
That is not the same as
engagement, by the way. So the sort of patient, I mean, the things that people are talking about besides being patient-centered are engaging patients and shared decision-making. Similar, but not exactly the same. So those are other qualities.
This is Mike Drop.
To follow up on that, one is whether we should actually add the wording of shared decision-making and engagement, because I don't see the word engagement in there, and I do think that's very important. But the other piece is also reiterating what you're saying is we have lots of metrics that we're doing around meaningful use or and many of them we're trying to be able to capture electronically to try and keep it efficient as opposed to people manually going through medical records, and I think we want to try and stay in that same vein.
Okay, Mike, can't see your hand, but we did hear you, so.
Yeah. I agree with what you said so far, but one thing that I wanted to just raise is that as I look at these measures, I don't see a reflection of measuring the population health. I look at them, and it seems to be measuring sort of people's experience with the system, but in terms of an accountable entity, improving the health of the population that serves, I don't think that's beyond the scope of what we're talking about. So I just thought that there should be something in there relative to population health measures.
Would that maybe fit down in nine? I'm just, you know, where we're talking about public reporting process. I mean, maybe it doesn't. But, I mean, I agree with you. We've had conversations within the health department about, you know, defining and measuring population health. Obviously, it's different from community to community within New York State. Goals for improvement may be different because the conditions, yep, the problems may be different.
Actually, to that point, I kind of read these as being guiding principles for provider payment, because population-based health is a kind of a different concept, whether you're talking about, you know, an ACO that's at risk or an entity that is responsible for population measures. So I think it might be kind of two different. I think it's hard to introduce, to hold a provider responsible for population-based outcomes unless they are being paid to focus on population-based. I mean, it's still do have.
Well, I think we should talk. I mean, for example, you know, an asthma rate, right, in one section of the city. I mean, folks know better than I. But, you know, our public health counterparts will tell us, right, since Medicaid is such a large payer, right, should there be community goals that are set out?
Right,
which obviously providers and networks that are being taken care of these patients, you know, should be.
Well, you certainly hold the Medicaid plans responsible for some of those indicators, but I just, I don't know. It's a totally different payment concept. So, you still have a range of different payment types for providers, right, from fee-for-service, for delivering that service and having an excellent outcome for that service, maybe measured by readmission rate, something like that, or just the quality of service and some of the process measures, you know, going down the line towards bundling or global payments or
risk-based, but the I think that, you know, I agree with the importance of population-based measures, which is not, I just would be careful both to introduce population-based standard to everything that you do, because you may not be paying somebody to focus on a population-based standard. If you want a network to focus on a population-based standard, that's a different story. You know, if you are passing along a global cap or something of that nature so that you're holding people accountable for population-based measures, that's a different story. But
would it be fair to say that, let's say, you know, the asthma rate in one community is twice the national average, whatever, I'm just throwing out there. But would it make sense for us to, in working with plans, right, to set a goal, right, that we want to reduce that asthma rate in half, whatever, we want to bring it back, and then as part of a payment strategy, try to reward that effort, incentivize that effort. I mean, is that a fair thing?
You're basically saying that you're...
Arlene, just a minute. Can we, Emma, Art, Steve, and you, and then Susan. Okay, I just want to make sure we get everybody.
I just wanted to make a comment that the principles and measures are primarily focusing on clinical measures. And when we talk about the alignment of providers, if this is geared towards providers, we're going to have providers and networks that are both medical and non-medical. So we really should think about measures that are specific to social measures. And I think your asthma, perhaps you need the medical component, but what about the, you know, the environment? What about the living
right.
arrangements of the individual? So I think that I see missing those social measures that really make the person whole.
So I guess the question I would ask in terms of defining the measure set is who's the accountable entity and what are we holding them accountable for, and then what are the appropriate measures for that. So it differs.
Right.
And
right.
it probably isn't a good idea to actually have one set of guiding measure principles for all. I mean, these are really very specific because you're going to actually be measuring people on or entities or organizations on this. So, I mean, I understand the discomfort level because I think we need to sort of parse this a bit.
I think that the common theme.
Sort of a list of people. So, Steve.
Okay. Yielding the floor. I think the common theme here is focus on outcomes, including population-based outcomes where appropriate. But the key, common thread is a focus on outcomes, and that could just be, you know, the rate of, you know, nosocomial infection. It could be reduction of aspirin. It depends on what it is you are paying for.
Yep.
But the key thing is outcome.
I support whatever. I mean, asthma rates in the community should be our goal to bring them down. But the environment and issues that we're not that we have no accountability for, we can't be held responsible for them. So we should hone in and tailor them to clinical issues. Readmissions or ED visits or hospitalizations or things like that, or, you know, hemoglobin A1Cs for diabetes, but not, I mean, none of us, unfortunately, have control for the kind of food that is being sold and the kind of environments that people are living in, which pressure people towards obesity and all kinds of issues. Corn subsidies have more to do with that than the care we're providing.
Yes, understood. I mean, I understand.
I would suggest that you might want to write a whole sentence instead of quality measures should, that would cover kind of what people are talking about, because it's too much under the umbrella. I did want to address, there's in number five, you're referring to risk adjusted, and I think we need to specifically address that it's not just the typical diagnosis-related risk. But socioeconomic factors have to be factored into the risk. And also, I think somewhere there needs to be a measure of cultural competence and linguistic competence in terms of a metric that providers should strive for.
Susan, then Scott.
So
So two comments. I mean, I wonder if we should say something about the quality measures, because I think these have been really good points about pairing the reimbursement reform with the quality measurement that would be appropriate. I mean, maybe we want to make that explicit, which is, you know, saying something along the lines of ensuring that quality measures are appropriately paired with the reimbursement reform being proposed. Because I think that makes it explicit. I mean, because I think you can ask a patient-centered medical home to look at population measures for their panel of patients across payers, but that's slightly different than the issue you were talking about. I think it's a building block for it, but it's, yeah, you know, so the funnel gets narrow. And then the second issue I had written down, I had wondered if it would be important to add a principle that says, this may be grouping too many things together, but be cognizant of national measure-setting processes, administrative burden, and IT or meaningful use capabilities. I think, you know, Phyllis mentioned that, Art mentioned, you know, a piece of that. And it's not that we wouldn't push. You could, if you're giving them more money and they're stepping up to the plate, you can push them, but they're...
No, I think we had a discussion about how resources intensive it is to gather the data on these measures, and I think we need to be, you know, sensitive to that. I think Dr. Sathier suggested that at maybe our last meeting that, you know, we should be positioning the department, right, to receive data via electronic medical record, because we're obviously spending a lot of money, you know, getting the healthcare provider system ready for electronic medical records. So, and we can put something in here on the national measure that we want to
align that alignment point.
Scott?
I'm going to raise a question rather than try and promote a particular point of view, but it gets back to something that Art talked about actually a couple of meetings ago. I'm still unclear as to, when I look at this, are we focusing on measuring outcomes or are we focusing on measuring process? And it was the point that you made. And I get concerned when we, there's no question outcome is what we all care about, but if you're talking about aligning incentives and payment structures, I think we have to be very cautious and maybe understand that when you're talking number five, risk adjusted, that outcomes are often, as Steve pointed, outside the context and realm of the accountability of any organization providing those services. If we're measuring outcomes, are we really able to understand to what degree the managing entity is able to affect those outcomes? Asthma is the perfect example. Mm-hmm. If we do everything right in our community, our outcomes may be lousy, because they're going home to environments that just don't allow medical management to make a meaningful difference. And I'm wondering if we need to acknowledge that in these principles and say it more specifically than five, where it's risk-adjusted. Risk-adjusted worries me. That means, you know, you're different risk when you're 20 than when you're 40 or what your genetics are. But there are a lot of other ways of measuring risk, and that's where it gets to the context of outcomes being outside the realm of what we can really be accountable for.
Mm-hmm.
I'm posing this. I'm asking whether or not we should be more specific. Are we looking at process? Are we measuring process? Are we concerned about that?
Rhonda?
So it bothers me, thinking back over the last couple of sessions, that I mean, the concept of population health, I think, needs to be embedded in everything we're doing. It may be a vision, but I'm wondering if it should in fact be reflected in both payment principles and other principles, because with this amount of reform, delivery and payment reform going on, we are going to set down footprints, and those footprints will have a legacy. And I think what we want is, in the distance, we want those to be built around communities and in such a fashion, and we want payment systems that allow for addressing social factors or environmental factors insofar as those, there's evidence that those are going to produce better outcomes. So I think that consideration needs to be laid down at this point in time. Let me give you some for instances. We want things built around geographic communities insofar as those are the where you have environmental conditions, where you have a lot of conditions that contribute to illness. So how we choose who will be the medical home providers, how we choose a lot of these things are going to make that easier or going to make it harder. And I think we need that consideration built in. I can't tell you at what level, but I think that's ultimately what we're trying to get to, is a system that addresses the social causes insofar as that's going to produce quality outcomes and cost reduction.
If we, just to take some of these thoughts, are we talking about quality measures in our innovative payment models? I mean, we're really limiting it to that. I think that's a key point. We're not talking about quality measures that make the world better, but we're talking about the ones that fit in this model. Now, in that, we've heard variations on population health, and Rhonda's point about this is a chance to make a footprint. I think we'd have to look for language that would make this part of an innovative payment model, not part of a principle that goes beyond this model. And we've heard access, choice of measures, socioeconomic adjustments in terms of risk adjustments, and still a lingering question in my mind, I think this was Steve, who is the accountable entity that we're asking these quality measures in an innovative payment system? Who's accountable for this? Is it the insurer? Is it the provider? I mean, exactly. I think that question still hangs. Marlene.
In our innovative payment model, so we have that principle two. And that principle two, I think, probably comes out of the very lengthy discussion we had about the Brooklyn situation. And we're saying that we want to be linked to reinforce health system planning. Now, once we interject that, the population health issues become relevant. So I think that maybe you're just trying to say that the innovative payment models ought to reinforce the health system planning, which ought to be based on population health, which ought to be measured. And I think you can weave it in without connecting it to a specific provider payment here or there.
Ron, does that address your concept?
Yes, it's explicit enough that when I read number two, which has an awful lot of things packed into it, you know, I see it there. And we are talking about laying down models. I mean, we're talking about models intellectually right now, but assuming the process moves forward, we're actually talking about implementing them. So, you know, thinking about where and how we're implementing them is really important.
Okay. Yes, Dan.
Just a minor supplemental thing, but on number four, maybe it would help at the end to add where clinically and socially appropriate. I was thinking of what Art's comments about all the measures out there that people are doing the work, and yet, we didn't want to duplicate. At the other hand, you know, we don't want to just apply everything, and it may not apply in every community. And I heard somebody earlier trying to find a place for saying something about what's clinically appropriate. And so I was thinking maybe a phrase like that at the end, where clinically and socially appropriate, would contain it a little bit.
Okay. Mike, have you any additional comments, or Jim? Okay. Rhonda?
Phyllis. Okay. So the only thing that I would say is these are, to me, very general guidelines which are appropriate, but I think what we're struggling is the guy, are we trying to measure quality at maybe at the HMO level, at the ACO level, at the home health level, at the provider level? And so I think if we could put maybe some narrative in the front that kind of says these are more generic and that one needs to be consistent with these kinds of guidelines and principles, but as applicable to who is receiving the funds or who we're trying to incent or who we're trying to measure. Because, for example, from an HMO, you would look at you might look at population, but if you're an individual provider or you're a health home, you're dealing with that patient. You're trying to organize the care of that patient. If you're the actual provider, you're actually delivering the care to that patient. They all have different measures, I think, like quality measures.
So we've taken these innocent and hopeful principles and battered them into improved submission. And so, Phil, you feel like you have most of these ideas?
We'll take a stab at it.
Okay. And these are all very good observations about this. I think this last point is a critical one, and maybe a preamble would help us, because it depends on exactly whom you're asking to respond, I think, as you point out. So that makes a difference in this.
You know, it's maybe the organization, the slides didn't help, and maybe we should have said this 20 minutes ago, but I think what we are attempting to do is put forth the principles here that relate to a recommendation we're going to come to. It's recommendation number 2, where we've suggested that there should be a core set of measures that are used and adopted across a series of sectors, including managed care and ACOs and BHOs and health homes. So I think it's a little bit more limited use of guidelines in effect. So I concur with what Phil said.
So are we comfortable that we have covered this topic? All right. With that, then we'll move on to the remainder of our task today is to go through our 4 potential recommendations, potential with a big P until they're discussed here. And the first of these is the recommendation on payment reform. John, do you want to introduce that?
Sure. I would just start off by saying that, you know, while we only have 4 potential recommendations here, and we know other groups have reported that they have double-digit recommendations, I would submit that these are probably going to be the most impactful and important of all those. So now we all feel good about that. Okay. So let me just kind of start. And we, you know, visited these at our last meeting, and Mr. Sisto, and when he reported to the larger MRT group, basically went through the 4 that we have targeted here. So the first one is, and I'll just kind of get our heads back into this, is that, you know, this recommendation is basically pursue a partnership agreement with CMS to integrate Medicaid and Medicare service delivery and financing for the dual eligible population. And at our last meeting, you know, we went through, we were actually, you know, quite surprised and even chagrined, you know, to learn that, you know, we do have 700,000 dual eligible members in the Medicaid program that receive both Medicaid and Medicare coverage. What we learned was that we estimate that somewhere in the neighborhood of $23 billion, almost half of the state's Medicaid program is spent on this population, and that our estimate, and again, that we found this quite curious that when we approached different groups within Washington, they didn't have an exact number for us, but our estimate that we cobbled together was that Medicare, it's about another $11 billion. We're going to fine-tune those numbers. You know, Pat is working with his counterparts within CMS for getting this large data file to confirm some of these numbers. But I think rest assured, you know, that people are now kind of waking up to the fact that this is a very expensive population and should be, you know, the focus of reform. And it's not just, you know, within New York State. There's obviously other think tank groups. We've had conversations with, you know, some of our contacts within Dartmouth. Or looking, you know, at, in particular at this population. So we also explained that, you know, we were one of 15 states identified to participate with CMS in a planning grant to give states the opportunity to develop new systems of care around the dual eligibles. In the communication and discussions that we've been having with CMS is that there's really 2 options that were offered to states. One is a managed fee-for-service type model, and the other was a 3-way capitation agreement. Within the last couple of weeks, have formally indicated to CMS that we're interested in in pursuing some new systems around this population. The third, or maybe option 2B that we're considering is actually what we call a 2-way agreement, where the state, in essence, would go at risk, receive a Medicare capitation payment, and then in turn, subcapitate with health plans or work up other, payment policies with provider groups across the state. So there's really 2 options being discussed at the federal level. We're considering a slightly different variation on that, which would involve the state going at risk for the full $11 billion. And within the department, we're developing this issue kind of crosses over with another MRT work group, you know, headed up, Mark Kissinger, staffing that. So we're having discussions about how does this fit within the other discussions that are, you know, taking place with the other MRT groups. Our intention here is that we're developing a concept paper that will be, you know, shared with you hopefully within the next, you know, couple of days to kind of line out, you know, some of the details here. But when we look at this, we basically, you know, see a set of goals here. And, you know, those goals are, you know, the triple aim. I think it fits in nicely with all the, you know, principles that we were, you know, just discussing, but improve patient care experience, improve the health of the population, and reduce the per capita cost of health care. The next is create opportunities for providers, payers, and patients to realize the financial benefits and improved outcomes as system efficiencies are achieved and quality benchmarks are obtained. Promote improved patient outcomes. And then we think that, you know, one, a large piece of this initiative, which will, we believe will be encompassed in, you know, a waiver proposal to CMS, would involve the need for an upfront investment of funds to basically, you know, allow us to implement, in essence, go at risk. But we know that we, you know, there's additional resources that we'll need, that you'll need, I think, before the state would be, you know, comfortable with us, you know, taking this approach. So and we've just lined out, and I think we discussed it at our last meeting, what some of those, you know, sources could be, you know, of upfront investment could be used for, but continued funding for care management, because we know the health home funding at the 90% FMAP expires at the end of 2 years, and our expectation is that this is going to be a successful effort. Health homes are going to have to be a success, and we're going to need to have a source of funding to continue to, you know, promote health homes. You know, HIT funds, we commonly hear, even though there's been a big bolus of funds that have been put forward and allocated, you know, to hospitals primarily, we know that there are other, you know, clinics and caregivers that are in need of HIT funding, which we believe would be is important for us to be successful here. We also heard from Dr. Safier that there were no dollars set aside as part of the Medicaid, Medicare integration for ACO. So we believe that there'll be some, you know, need for startup, you know, funding along the way. There's other things that we've talked about that we would, you know, try to build into this initiative, which is, you know, shared savings. Again, one of the conversations that we've had here in the past is that we want to make sure that when systems efficiencies are realized, that, you know, plans and providers both benefit from improved performance, and not all the dollars get taken out of the system, you know, cross, you know, into, you know, in the insurer's bottom line, or even for that matter, back to the state, you know, general fund financial plan. So again, we need to develop strategies for which, when we can measure improved performance, whether that's preventable admissions, preventable emergency room use, whatever the measures are that we come up with, that, and if that generates tangible savings, that we want to find ways to invest those savings, you know, back into the healthcare system. So, I mean, that's basically it. We've had, you know, maybe Donnie, you want to talk a little bit about, you know, we've had some, you know, conversations with CMS. I found to be actually quite productive. They're probably pushing us even a little bit harder than we're pushing on them at this point, because I think there is a level of excitement here. They know that we're engaged in this. We've informed them that we have this MRT process and that the input of this group is very important for us to move forward. We explained to them we thought we had a pretty positive meeting at our last session. So they're kind of waiting for us. We want to make sure that, you know, folks here are going to endorse this, you know, recommendation in general. And I think from that, I'll just open it up for discussion.
This is a topic that we certainly discussed more than others in our last meeting. And I just want to get out here before we begin the discussion that we're basically being asked to recommend pursuit of an agreement. And the terms of the engagement would be negotiated at the conclusion of the pursuit. So that's really our question of the day. Marlene?
So this is probably going to be a big evolutionary process to take on this very complex population, and it is going to be risk for the state. So I would be careful in the waiver application that you build in that the incentives perpetuate. So you're going to get little improvements and then you get more improvements, and you don't want to have it be that, you know, like, you know, to my own point, medical home development in itself, no. It's the development, the improvement, the outcomes you get with them. There's going to be continuous investment needed, and I think you got to make that clear to the feds, because you want to make a good deal, because you're going to take, what do we say, $11 billion, something like that, of risk?
Yeah, our estimate is $11 billion. I think that those are all excellent points. I think one thing that's been just brought up in our discussions is how we share risk. I mean, there's a part of me that says we know that we have a lot of work to do to get to full integration. And it's certainly not unfair to go to the federal government and say, if we're going to receive a capitated payment, that in the first year, right, that cap payment shouldn't be discounted by 5% or whatever it is. Maybe it's just we're going to stay at our current level of funding when we set the cap payment, because we know it's going to take time for us to assume the risk. It's going to take time for you to develop, you know, these new system approaches. And then, and that's right. And as we're generating tangible savings, maybe that's the source from which we do the continuous investment. But at that point, if it all works out, really the ball's in our hands, our collective hands with this option 2B. So I think the other point, and I think Mr. Sisto raised this, is that, you know, as we're sharing risk with provider networks, with this population, it's got to be, you know, a flexible, you know, approach that we undertake over time. Because we know that, you know, just from the very beginning to assume risk with this population, even though I think there's plenty of opportunity here to achieve savings and improve care, I think we need to move, you know, carefully.
Phyllis and Steve.
So I have potential suggestion around the waiver and in working with the federal government. And, you know, right now on Medicare, many institutions are losing money now, and it wasn't that way probably a decade ago. And Medicaid has not covered the cost for many years as well. And I think one of the goals should be is get that excess out, guys, and all that money goes towards getting those rates closer to covering costs, because we've got this huge cross-subsidization that's not going to be forever. And I think that this would be a transition of getting the government payers to getting closer to fully paying for costs and having that realignment go on. I think we are going to need a glide path to make that change in the industry.
I think I'm speaking.
Bill, could I jump in? Jim Talon.
Yes, Jim, please do.
I mentioned at the last meeting, and I don't know where it fits or when it fits, but I think as we move forward on this thing, we just have to be explicit somewhere with each other of when we're going to raise the question of the beneficiary choice issue here, because we're talking in terms of savings and plans and providers, and yet the lightning rod in this one is going to be ultimately the mechanism that is used to engage Medicare beneficiaries in this process or in this plan, whether it's an opt-out or something like that. At some point, that issue is going to trigger, and I guess my judgment would be that we've got a long way to go on this one. We'd be better off to trigger it and put out some of the options of how one could approach that as part of our discussion. And there may be different points of view on that one, but I don't think we can ignore that issue is going to come up.
Can I respond to that? I think on the Medicaid side of this, that we should take a position that there isn't an opt-out. On the Medicare,
I agree. There is the Medicaid side of this, in my view. Clearly, the state has authority, and we have made a policy determination of where we're heading on this, and I buy that. It's the Medicare side.
Yes. So the Medicare side is going to be the Medicare side, and it's going to play out. But there are ways to create shared savings models that approximate capitation, and that really is what the Pioneer ACO is about. In reference to what Phyllis said, switching subjects, and Marlene said, I think that in a very difficult population that adds the complication of two payers, that we should have very
very well-constructed glide paths towards what we're doing. The return on this long-term is huge for the state and for the federal government. So we got to get it right. So the investment in making this work is going to be large because you're cutting across so many different borders and such divergent payers, even though they're the federal sources, CMS, and perpetuity. In perpetuity has to be a cardinal principle one way or another, because if we're hugely successful and we exceed what the glide path predicts, and then suddenly it ends, you fall off the cliff. I mean, there is no reason to do it. It is not rational. If you get tremendous overuse out of the system and you manage the care towards better optimization of health for the patients, and then suddenly the rug is pulled out from under you, and especially at the moment when you're really getting the return. So one way or another, we need to get into a model that says this is in perpetuity. This is not a two-year thing or a three-year thing or a two-and-a-half-year thing. It has to be in perpetuity.
Okay. You and I fully agree on that. My question is when somebody is going to tell the Medicare beneficiary that they're part of this discussion.
There is. The model is in the Pioneer ACO.
Go ahead.
So there is no question that the system of care for duals is disjointed and that there's huge opportunity to make it better, and in making it better, to save money for both programs. Okay? I think that the general principles that are here are fine because they're general, but, you know, I personally think that the state's ambition here is very bold and, you know, admire boldness. But my approach to it, speaking from where I am, because, you know, I think that it's a huge program and it's a very complicated population that has never, ever been in any managed system of care. We're talking about, you know, mentally incompetent people who are resident in nursing homes, adults and children who are in facilities for the developmentally disabled and the mentally retarded, people with very complex behavioral health issues, et cetera, et cetera. I think, so my approach to this, honestly, is a little bit different. It goes back to the first slide that Greg showed on health homes. Where is the delivery network? Who's capable of actually building a program that can manage the care better than what exists now? And those are the building blocks. Again, it's like I understand, and, you know, you guys are going to do whatever you want. You know, I'm not here to tell you what to do. But going for the whole enchilada and saying, give us the $11 billion so we can put it together with the, whatever, $15 billion that the state spends, and we'll kind of, like, reform the whole. I just think it's a lot to bite off. And to Jim's point, from a slightly different perspective, to me, it's like you figure out first how to deliver the benefit better, and then you figure out how you work with CMS to, or, you know, maybe it's in smaller bites. I mean, I said this to you before. I get, you know, for me, I'd want to see an awful lot more about your analysis of where the opportunities are, how you put together a delivery system that's very dispersed in the community. I mean, look at the issues around just even putting the behavioral health benefit into some sort of managed system when the physical health benefit for those people is already being managed. It's complicated, and when you're going, you know, deep into the dual population, you're going where no man has gone before. And I just really think that it's the right thing to do. You know, it's the future, but I, for one, you know, get a little bit sort of, I would hesitate before saying, yes, Dave, take all the money. I know you can figure it out. Health homes are great. They are. They're all the building blocks. But to me, when I look at this opportunity with CMS, I'm looking at it at a much more granular level, you know, maybe because of where I sit. Like, how do you actually deliver this benefit to those people so that it's better than what they have now, that you you are sensitive to the fact that, you know, there are a lot of consumer choice issues around this, and how do you make every step that you take so successful that people will embrace the idea that this is better? I mean, so.
Joanne?
This is Mike Kropp.
Go ahead, Mike.
I just have a question in terms of this recommendation, and specifically what it commits us to, because the concerns that are being expressed are very real, but if what we're talking about commits us to sort of dive in and really better understand what infrastructure needs to be put in place, how the risk transfer will be affected over time, and really partner with CMS or a subset of CMS on this, it's very different than, you know, we're fully committed and waiting for that black box to be opened up. So I just wanted to understand better what this recommendation really commits us to, a process of exploration where we can answer some of the questions that are being raised, or we're kind of way down the aisle.
Yeah, I think what we're talking about here is basically an endorsement that the state would move forward and pursue a waiver agreement that would involve going at risk for the dual population in some form. How that plays out, I mean, everything Pat said is exactly right. I mean, this is a place where, you know, states have dabbled in. You know, there's models, a bunch of models out there. We can go on and on about all these different approaches. I think the other thing to think about is, you know, basically, you know, and I'll use this word, and I don't think I'm overstating it, is that, you know, the state in certain sectors is under attack, and their Medicare program is under attack. And, you know, there's, you know, huge GME hospital cuts. We've, you know, read the analysis put forward, you know, by Greater New York. So, while it is bold, there's no doubt about that, and it will only work if we make it work together as a healthcare community in this state. If we're not committed to making this work together, it will not be a success. But, I mean, on one hand, we're weighing some pretty sizable cuts. You know, maybe the deficit reduction committee fails and we get a 2% this year, but I don't know what's in store next year. I don't know. You know, more than likely, probably more cuts. But what we are doing is, under this option, is that we would be taking a significant piece of the Medicare program and basically putting it in our collective hands to figure out how to manage it.
Joanne? No, Joanne was there.
Yeah, thanks. I agree with Pat's comments about the magnitude of this and a couple reactions. I mean, on the home health side, and a lot of the duals right now are in home health as patients. I mean, I don't know what percentage, but it's got to be a high, very, very high percentage. Next April 1, we see all the home health population, all of it, move into a mandatory enrollment setting where right now, you know, I mean, April 1 is not that far away. There's so much uncertainty as to where they're going to land, what providers are going to look like, how they're going to participate. There's also a very limited view from the other MRT work group, the MLCC work group, about allowing even provider-based models to continue to exist that aren't insurance-based. So we have a mammoth movement, and this is, it is bold and ambitious, but I just worry about the unintended consequences of moving the most complex patients that we have in the Medicaid program, whether it's behavioral health, and the OPWDD system, I mean, is undergoing its own big 1115 waiver that's sort of separate from that initiative. So one of the things I worry about is between now and then, where there's no language that kind of reflects this provider stability that needs to take hold, or at least have some concrete signals sent to it on the home health side, certainly from the state, which doesn't exist right now. And I get calls from home health agencies every day who are saying,
I'm trying to budget for next year. I don't know whether I'm going to be a care coordination model. I don't know whether an MLTC is going to want to contract with me. You know, there's one model that the state has right now. It has 30,000 patients in it that its future is uncertain. So there's so much angst and anxiety. And when I look at this, and this bold and this is the right way to go, you know, integrating patients, creating the right incentives across the board. But I just worry about the magnitude and what's going to happen to all of those buckets. You know, I think about Greg's slide at the first meeting of the four quadrants and who those patients are, and just proceeding very cautiously and slowly, because what we don't want is, in the meantime, to have a lot of providers that kind of fall off the map a little bit in between now and then. And we're already seeing that in upstate New York in small communities. I mean, you're seeing access issues on the home care side right now that are taking hold.
Phyllis and Steve.
I have a couple questions. One is the $11 billion that you estimate is the Medicare for the dual eligibles. That's $11 billion out of how much Medicare money coming to New York State? Do we have any clue? Is that what percentage of it?
Yes, again. I mean, I think when we started our efforts to put together that slide that has the two intersecting circles, right? You know, Bill and staff, right? I said, look, we gotta get the slide, right? I mean, somebody's gotta have the answer to this, right? And it was like, and then as I started to pursue it, it became pretty obvious to me, you know. And again, we contacted our friends at Dartmouth that do the Dartmouth Atlas, and we said, you know, how can this be? How is it that people don't, you know, nobody really knows how much this population is costing the healthcare system? And that's when they came back to us and said, yeah, this is our latest, you know, effort, right, to understand what this population is, how they access services. And from that, you know, there was an offer for Dartmouth to maybe help us with, you know, implementation or helping us with, you know, creating different, you know, ideas in terms of how to, you know, develop service models for this population. And we said, you know, we'll be in touch, and that sounds great. But in answer to your question, our estimate is this is 41% of the Medicare pie. That's our
that we get of New York State.
We're talking about 41% of the pie. Now,
We're scrambling.
Yeah, no, it is. That's a lot of money. I mean, we can come back to you, and they can come back to us, because they're sharing a file, or they've shared a file with Pat, right, that basically allows us to match by person, right, their Medicaid expenditures with their Medicare expenditures, right? And that file we've been waiting for over a year now, right? Do we have it now, Pat?
It's not a file. We're in process of getting the Medicare data.
Right. But from this, we'll be able to tell.
Theoretically, we will.
Well, I mean, you know, because when you think about it, if you could protect the state from the Medicaid and Medicare dish cuts that are coming down the road and the productivity, if we could say these are the dollars and hold on to those dollars and work within them instead of having them ratcheted down, I mean, it could be enormously beneficial. And then if we all had, we'd have much more aligned incentives. We'd have more integrated payment systems with this patient population that has two different payment systems, which is just miserable to bill even, I mean, let alone try and take care of the patients the right way. So I think, you know, it's a huge undertaking, and it's scary from the transformation. But it doesn't say that anything changes from today right now if the money's continue. The question is how over time, and it would take a decade, I think, to really move it fully, but it is bold as an understatement.
Pat, can I would make, taking in what you're saying, I would support this for all those reasons, and I would try to get us be as strong as we possibly could in favor of what you're saying, because the alternative is just endless cuts. So both are problematic, endless cuts and or bold risk. Pat, I'm going to ask you a question, because I think buried in what you were saying, and there was almost nothing I disagreed with, standards, thoughtfulness, being careful
not to harm patients and populations. I still somehow hear something else you're saying, which is you're advocating for an intermediary. I think you are. You could say no, but I think you are, and I think that's in what you're saying. I'm all for intermediaries, as you are, but I am not in favor of putting this $11 billion on a platter for UnitedHealthcare, which will just take the money out and send it somewhere else. It's too much money, and we have to be careful about how the money is used. We want to keep the money in the system so that the care is provided.
It's not actually, I mean, I might think that I could do a great job. What I'm saying is that $11 billion, however many hundred thousands of people, all we're talking about is money. Like, what about the people? You know, they're Medicare beneficiaries. They are in the system today. They get care. They get protections. They get benefits. And honest to God, I mean, I love you guys, but we don't have a plan. These are like the most vulnerable people who live in New York State. I'm saying you go incremental because I've been looking at the three-way contract, and I'm down in the details of how do I build a program to take care of, let's say, people who are resident in a nursing home. You do have Evercare models out there, and you do have PACE programs on a small level. I think that ultimately this is what has to happen, but I am saying incremental, and I don't care if it goes directly to you, Steve, in the Bronx, or to me as a health plan, or to Emma as, you know, a nursing home, long-term care facility. I don't care. I'm saying build the program for the beneficiary first. Do that first and show that you can do it better than what it exists now. And then, you know, but you can't, I think that for the state to take all that money and sort of say, trust me, beneficiaries, providers, you know, providers, how are you going to get paid fee-for-service until all these systems develop? There's just a lot of detail in this.
I think that to some extent we're negotiating with ourselves, and I'm not sure why we're doing that at this juncture. This recommendation, and perhaps I'm missing the point, is not prescriptive. It's basically stating that we need a partnership with CMS. It doesn't describe what that partnership is. It doesn't talk about who's taking risk. Nor should it at this juncture. I'm not sure it's within the purview of this committee today to detail the negotiations. I think that the point has to be along the lines of what Steve and I think we're all saying, in essence, this does need to be a bold step. I know that we have to have protections built in to it, and that will be negotiated with CMS. We're not here today to try and articulate every caution in the negotiation. We're here to articulate a principle. And I think that the principle is inarguable, quite frankly. We have to pursue a partnership with CMS in order to preserve the dollars that are coming into the state, and then we have to, at the same time, after we agree to this principle, then reconvene, whether this group or another group or a different set of people, and argue the details of it. I understand the devil being in the details. We all know that. But today, how does one argue against what you put on the slide? I'm having a hard time understanding that.
I just, if I may, just a minute. As the chair, I try to present the problem when we began. The question before us is pursuit, I think, to Scott's point. The pursuit of this agreement is what we are being asked about today. The details of that agreement, we are not. What has occurred in this discussion is a fairly thoughtful expression of concern about what if we capture, you know, I mean, what if we are successful? Are we prepared to be successful in this pursuit? That's the lurking question. I think for the group, we have to decide today whether the concerns about the second part of that, are we prepared to deal with success, outweighs the decision to pursue this. To me, that is what lies before the group today. And I think there have been valid points on both sides. We have 3 minutes to come to a conclusion. Marlene.
I think an important consideration is why are we pursuing this, and I think that's been the nature of the argument. And I think you've presented two very important discussions. One is a political calculation that says that in order to preserve the healthcare dollars coming from the Medicare program, we must pursue this because for whatever reason, a lot of our funding is on a chopping block, right? So there needs to be a political calculation whether or not that funding is more secure in a waiver or through our delegation and our lobbying in Washington. I'm not sure which is right on that. And we haven't had that discussion. I'm sure that you guys back in the Capitol have the experts on that and are better at making that judgment, that political calculation, in which scenario is New York's Medicare program likely to get cut less. I think Pat is the conscience of this conversation and saying, well, if we're going to pursue it, we're pursuing it only to preserve a budget, to prevent a budget cut, or in order to create a budget opportunity. We ought to do a bottom-up analysis of pursuing it as if we knew what we were doing. Because if we don't know what we're doing, we ought not to pursue this.
Dan, do you have any comments on this? Dan Sisto?
Thank you. I guess I would be for this, but I would also note that what you're almost describing in a way of sort of expectations or conditions under which at least we as an MRT or MRT subgroup would feel good about sending our negotiators forward. Phyllis made the point at the very beginning. You know, if the federal government's willing to have a test that compares us to the savings that we accrue from today forward, that's excellent. If they say, we're going to cut the hell out of Medicare in the next 4 or 5 years and Medicaid too, and no matter how much you save, we're going to compare you to that lower baseline, well, now we're going to get the worst of both worlds anyway. So a lot of this is negotiation. But Steve makes the point, given an effective negotiation, this is the path to pursue. This is what we need to do. We need to take the risk because there is a certain risk of going in the traditional direction. So as Pat says, we all understand this is inevitable, but can we make sure that the computer has chips inside of it before we purchase it, right? So one could negotiate, like on the health homes, one could negotiate a strategy of targeted and phased implementation with the feds. There's ways of dealing with this, but we also have to be cognizant that at least in many cases, states cut waivers with CMS, which are negotiations with the administration only. And oftentimes, in fact, rarely are they brought before a legislature or some other body subsequent. The CMS doesn't particularly care what goes on, generally speaking, in states internally. They just deal with administrations. So that's why I started this by saying, there might be an exclamation point or points of emphasis. I don't know if there's a better word than conditions, but expectations seems mild. But the caveats that you've noted, I think, are all important, and yet I would vote for pursuing it, for voting yes.
Okay, I'm going to, because I think unless there are new thoughts to what has been a well-framed debate here in terms of the political imperative that is motivating us, as Marlene pointed out, the questions of our own capability, if we are successful, as Pat has articulated, Phyllis and Steve and others have said, it is a risk process with certain capabilities. If there are additional thoughts other than those to the debate, I would ask that those be put into play, and then I think we have to sort of decide how we want to play this today. Susan.
Just one quick thought. I wonder if the department would continue to use this group or a version of this group in support of what it does with negotiations, because it seems to me that a number of folks really want to support this, I being among them, but I think there are a number of really tremendous points being made that maybe we could be useful. I'm sure no one wants to commit any more time, but I just did it.
Are there?
I'll just quickly. I think that makes absolute sense. This, as I said, will only be successful if, as New York State, as a group of healthcare providers, make it successful. And I'm certainly, I know that I'm talking more about financing, but certainly how this affects patient care is really what's most important here. And
it will only work if we can do it together. I mean, we'll certainly take this back to the second floor and have discussions with folks, but I think this whole process is based on your input, the whole MRT process. And I see in this huge initiative makes complete sense that we would, you know, form somebody. If it's the same body, great. But it makes sense to me that there would be a lot of guidance being provided to the Department of Health. And
yeah,
as we enter the negotiation room with CMS, certainly there too.
All right. In soccer parlance, we're in extra time.
Yeah, I just have a quick question, John. Is there an opportunity, and I'm sure you guys have thought this, that we could learn from the California and perhaps Texas waivers to help us kind of shape this going forward? You know, if we are successful, you know, what can we learn from that and kind of use to kind of think about some of the concerns that were expressed here today?
Well, we've been spending a lot of time with our counterparts in California, understanding their waiver arrangement. Marlene and Lorraine Brown have also had some conversations with the public hospital system as well, because even though we won't be following, you know, the same goals that, you know, that California got out of the waiver, we know that we're going to need an investment of funds. And California was very successful there in securing that investment. We have some ideas that we're putting together in terms of how we could go about bringing in some more federal dollars as startup funds. We're still thinking those, you know, thinking that all through, but we think we have a strategy there.
Donna, one last word.
Yeah, I would just say that I think other state waivers are instructive, but having been around waivers for a number of years now, I think once you've seen one waiver, you've kind of seen one waiver. I don't know any waiver. There's no waiver that we're aware of that does exactly this, but yet there's some strategies. It's helpful to know what HHS has approved and what they haven't, so I think that's valid. The only other thing, if I could say really quickly, Dr. Stuck, is, you know, I think it's important to know that the alternative to pursuing a partnership with CMS is sort of to do nothing. And this system is broken for the duals. I mean, you know that better than we do. I mean, we have organizations close to being Pioneer ACO. We have the largest PACE programs in the nation. We have probably the second or first largest dual SNP in the country. I think what we really want to do is harness what we all know, go forward to CMS, and forge a partnership with them directly, as opposed to some of kind of like these arrangements we've done through Medicare Advantage plans that, you know, seek to treat the dual.
Okay, Steve, one last comment.
I think the discussion, unfortunately, was framed at the beginning not from the conscience point of view. And I think your point, Donna, is the most important point, which is the current model is terrible care. So I think it's unequivocal that we need to move to change it, and the only way to move to change it is to integrate what CMS can't do to itself. Second point, I'd like to answer Marlene's question. I think there's a clear answer to it. In the current climate in Washington, the only alternative is to take the money to New York State from a political point of view, because even the president is wobbly on these issues. Medicare and Medicaid are on the chopping block. DISH, GME, other things that make our systems whole are being offered up at basement level now that only goes up. So having New York State have the money, and New York State has an MRT process. The federal government has a super committee.
Don't compare us with them. Okay. okay.
How does it work? It's kind of Jim Talon's question. Most of this population, most of that $11 billion is a fee-for-service Medicare program. How do you get around the fact that there still is an option for Medicare enrollees? It's not a mandatory environment. So how does the state, do the feds waive that as part of their agreement? They waive the mandatory?
Well, what a number of states have done and what HHS talks to us about is what I think Jim Talon raised as an opt-out issue. It is, in the eyes of HHS, a voluntary program where individuals are assigned through some more intelligent system than just randomly to a care management system, and within 60 days they can opt out. That's their option. That's one alternative, but it is something that we would need to obviously talk about. Any 1115 requires a stakeholder engagement process, and we would do it anyway, even if it wasn't required by the feds. But that is one of the issues that we'd need to, you know, vet with beneficiaries, vet with groups like this, and then have discussions with HHS.
This has been a very thoughtful discussion. I'm going to close the discussion tab, unless there's an certainly.
I'm confused. Is this recommendation that you're asking for consensus on, that the state pursue a waiver to receive all of the money as a capitated entity, as opposed to it's a general description to pursue something, including the solicitation that you guys just responded to that CMS is actually offering? So I'm confused when, Donna, you say if we don't do the state waiver, we do nothing. Are we not pursuing the Melanie Bella approach? Or
the state Medicaid letter we responded to as a placeholder did not talk about the state accepting risk from CMS for Medicare. We talked before in one of our meetings about how they're two different things. We don't know that either of those models gets us really to where we need to be. I mean, we're not certain that either of those models gives a state and its delivery system the autonomy to work with the combined funding between Medicare and Medicaid.
The solution to this is for the state.
That's right.
I apologize, Pat. Are there other questions rather than comments to add to the debate? Okay, this has been a very enlightening and thoughtful discussion. I think the question before the group is weighing the politics, weighing the consequences. Does the MRT group feel that this is a recommendation that would be, this is our group, view this as a recommendation that would it be supported and recommended to the overall MRT group? That is the question before us. And it would be the recommendation essentially as phrased here. The concerns and caveats, I think, could embellish our thoughts here and certainly would have to be recorded somewhere that we have some fundamental concerns as a group should it advance. So I guess the question, unless there are other questions, the question is the group's feeling on this recommendation. And so I would ask for those who favor the recommendation, it's moved beyond potential. Now we're into a recommendation. On payment reform, recommendation number one, if you believe that this is an appropriate recommendation for this group, please raise your hand.
My hand's raised.
Okay.
Mine too.
Let's actually get a count. 1, 2, 3. Okay, and if you do not feel this is the case, please raise your hand. So the vote by the group is 11-2 in favor of this recommendation. And that's with great respect for those who offered their concerns about this. Okay, we are behind schedule, which means we'll have to sacrifice lunchtime as a penalty for inefficiency. Why don't we try to resume at, we'll be merciful here, 10 after, okay, and start again. Thank you.
Bill, I'm going to be a little delayed in rejoining you because of a Regents meeting, but I'll be back on as soon as I can.
Okay. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you.